Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
It's Sunday morning, the day after Word of the Park. How are you feeling, Mark?
I feel righteously knackered, actually. I got home last night really early, actually. We'd been in the pub for about 4 hours. I got home by 8 o'clock and had something to eat. And I just sat on the sofa with my wife and I actually just fell asleep. Just wiped out.
Not surprised.
That amount of social activity too. Very good fun. Though.
And just to recap it, for anybody who's never been to one, it's basically how it works is that, we do this event in the venue of Opera Holland Park in Holland Park. And we've been incredibly fortunate for the last 3 years now that the weather has smiled upon us.
Gorgeous.
It was absolutely gorgeous. And so, we have a number of guests who chat. And yesterday we had Bob Stanley and Leslie Ann Jones and John Higgs and Claire Grogan and loads of people turn up, and it's lovely to see old familiar faces and new ones and so forth. And that's great. But the thing I really look forward to is going to the pub.
That first taste of a pint of Guinness.
God. Because no drink you feel is more relished and deserved.
Yeah, you said that was best drink of the year. I thought it was rather good, actually. Best drink of the year.
Once you've done that whole thing, you've had weeks thinking about it and getting it set up, with you and Alex and the various speakers and James at Opera Holland Park. I mean, it's just a huge number of people involved, over time. And we went to the pub afterwards with a bunch of mates and people who'd been on the show and so forth, with the sun shining. And my God, I enjoyed that drink.
That was good. Did I tell you about my conversation with Ian Brodie?
Go on.
Ian Brodie of the Lightning Seeds came to the show yesterday, and he came to the pub with us. Fabulous. I never met him before, actually. Fantastic bloke. Really, really interesting. I had a long conversation with him, and I was asking about Three Lions. And he said, and it really interested me, he said it's become completely divisive for his audience, because Three Lions is a song that supports England.
Yeah.
So therefore, their popularity, Lightning Seeds' popularity in Scotland and in Wales and Ireland, has really, really, really been affected by that. So I never would have struck me. He said it was really good because they recorded it and they weren't going to play it live. They were just going to go and do their Lightning show, a Lightning Seeds show. And then he said, after that became a kind of hit, he said dads and lads would turn up. So the front few rows would be full of dads with their young sons, in their England kit, waiting to hear that song. And they weren't prepared to play it. They hadn't rehearsed it. So they thought, well, we're going to have to rehearse it. We're going to have to play it. And once they started playing it, it divided the audience. He said he once did, they used to be able to do 3 nights in Barrowlands in Glasgow. Barrowlands is big. It's about 1,800 seats venue. He said they can barely fill a pub up there now. really interesting. So all this, and I really understand it, because actually the English don't feel that way so much about the others. Well, we kind of understand the Welsh.
The one thing that unites the Irish, Scottish and Welsh football supporters is they really do not want to see England celebrated in any way.
Anything at all, exactly. Whereas we got to try and imagine what it'd be like if that kind of, you know, the national anthem was kind of red dragon on the shirt or something. I don't know, it's hard to imagine. It's about England, and where if you're English, you just kind of think, well, that's wonderful. But he said it's become a real, real problem for them, you know, because it's actually really affected their live standing in all sorts of areas outside of England. So I never have crossed my mind that would have happened.
No, never across my mind.
Anyway, he's a super. Mate, he's got a memoir coming out, actually, written by John Higgs, or ghostwritten by John Higgs, I think, later in the year. Very interesting.
Yeah, so it was a big success yesterday. I think everybody who came thoroughly enjoyed it.
Claire Grogan, wonderful. We've talked to her before several times, and there's always laughter, and there's always tears, Dave.
There's always tears.
It's one of my favourite bits of Claire Grogan. She suddenly burst into tears talking about how much she loved singing. And then she said, I realise I love applause, at which point everybody clapped. Said, yeah. And I really like loud applause, which everybody massively loved. And I think she said, I quite like cheering too. The place was going mad, you know. She was brilliant. And Bob Stanley, Bob Stanley talking about the Bee Gees. Potty, pilly and boozy, didn't he call them at one point? Yes. According to their different kind of recreational drug habits, you know. John Higgs told that lovely story about George Lazenby when he was in the Bond films, not being allowed by Cubby Broccoli to go to the Bond premiere. The only one he was in, it. He was only in one Bond film, because he'd grown his hair too long.
He's grown
no
his
longer
hair.
Was on brand for
but you see, this is what I was discussing with John. I did an event with John in at the Bath Literature Festival a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the Beatles and James Bond. His book is about the Beatles, James Bond, which, you know, both emerged. The first James Bond film came out literally the same day as Love Me Do, the first Beatles thing.
Yeah.
So they are the two great phenomena of British entertainment were born together. And we're talking about how the Beatles is essentially a kind of Shaggy concept, and Bond is essentially a Brill Cream concept, isn't it? You know, it's all, again, Mark, I'm sorry to keep coming back to this. It's all about the
all
hair.
My hair, which is your
it's all about the hair. And I was able to pursue this point with Bob Stanley on the subject of the Bee Gees, because Barry Gibb was a person who, for the majority of his career, you know, hid behind a beard and was utterly obsessed with the beard.
Yeah, he was.
And then decided to shave it off for his... when he was making a major feature film debut in Now Voyager, or remake of Now Voyager, actually directed by or produced by the guys from Hypnosis Films, I think I'm right in saying.
Oh, right.
And, you know, shaved off the beard and film disaster.
Yeah.
Absolute disaster.
But he didn't work. He's a bearded concept.
He's a completely
bearded. Probably a lot of people just didn't recognise him. You know?
Absolutely. He's like ZZ Top. You know, he doesn't work as a clean-shaven concept. Although I was watching an interview with Billy Gibbons the other day, who said there was a brief period when Frank Beard from ZZ Top had a beard.
Did he?
Yeah, just that must be the kind of the Penny Black of ZZ Top pictures, mustn't it?
Yeah, it must be
Frank Beard with an actual beard.
With no beard. Yeah, yeah.
So remind me, Royal Blood.
Royal Blood. This was earlier in the week. Was it last weekend? No, actually, Royal Blood played on Radio One weekend show, I think, in Dundee, and this clip just went everywhere, didn't it? Royal Blood. A two-piece band. They're just a rhythm section, really. They're a bass player and a drummer. And they went on a bill, I think, between, I can't remember who it was now, I think it was Lewis Capaldi and maybe Wet Leg or something. So it wasn't a very rock event. But their whole thing is they're a rock band, you know. They are the most kind of aggressive, hard-hitting, full-on kind of, big brand rock band. And they felt that they weren't received very well. Actually, if you look at this clip, there's quite a lot of applause, you know, it's very polite. They're not getting booed or anything like that. You know, people just thinking fair enough. But it's not part of the mix of that day, clearly, a rock band suddenly appearing. And the bass player, the leader, just suddenly decides that they're not getting enough applause, and keeps going on about, can you be bothered to applause? And he says, at one point, he says, does anybody like rock music? No, nine people. Great, you know. And he says something like, I guess we should introduce ourselves, seeing as no one actually knows who we are. We're called Royal Blood, and this is rock music, which has become a huge kind of meme now, is it, on social media. It's just pictures of duos, you know, Little and Large, and Morecambe and Wise, or whatever, just saying, we're called Royal Blood, and this is rock music. And eventually he just leaves. They leave in a fury, and... having kind of insulted the audience on the TV cameras, and he leaves giving the kind of single finger salute as he goes off stage, and everyone piled in saying this was an absolute catastrophe and this would be doing them a lot of harm. I don't agree, actually. I think it'd be doing them a lot of good. Don't you?
Yeah, really?
Well, I don't do, know, because really. it's kind of old.
It's an old, stupid little story, isn't it? You know,
it's a
classic 21st century. Absolute storm in a digital teacup, isn't
Completely.
It?
Completely.
Because from what I can gather, as you say, they weren't going down badly at all.
They're not going down badly.
But clearly...
They
used to playing in front of their fans.
Exactly.
Because if you go and do a Radio 1 show, you're not playing in front of your fans, you're playing in front of all kinds of people, and that's fair enough. That's the way it should be. But obviously, somebody... Probably, dare I say it, somebody in the BBC digital wing thought, I can clip this together.
Yeah.
Like, I make it look as if they're kind of aggrieved, you know, aggrieved posh boys, which is
the yeah, that's the other
which
thing.
Which came
they,
over.
They do sound really posh and really kind of entitled.
You know, so obviously they put that together to put over that kind of message, you know,
yeah.
And which is the way it was taken, and you know, you might be right, it possibly wouldn't have done them any harm at all. But I was the thing that amazed me is the kind of level of the kind of vicious, you know, criticism aimed at them because of this stupid, neither here nor there thing. And it was just such a reminder. And there was another case of it this week, which was Noel Gallagher performing, having the temerity,
to perform Love Will Tear Us Apart.
Love Will Tear Us Apart. And in both cases, you think, just so many people just waiting to vent their indignation.
Because I felt that with Royal Blood. I felt that a lot of people probably had no real opinion about Royal Blood. Don't care about it. Just want to get in there and give somebody a kicking. And you're right. You know, the only issue is, if you're playing to your own fans, they're already converted and you're going to get a riotous reception. If you're at a festival, as you know, you've got to win people over. You know, I think it would do them a lot of good, because I think anybody who likes rock music would like that stand that they made. You know, but the Noel Gallagher thing is amazing, because it struck me that Love Will Tear Us Apart is a kind of, people think they own that song, don't they? I can't think of a song that people seem to care more and are more precious about. You know, I had a look to see, I was just interested, and there have been, I think, about 80 cover versions, but very, very few by anybody well known. Simple Minds did one, Bush did one, June Tabor did one, the Royal Philharmonic did one. But outside of that, you know, no one's dared to take it on, because probably for that reason, actually, is that people are, it's sacrosanct, isn't it? Don't you think?
Well, it's, I don't know about sacrosanct, but I think it's pretty foolish to try and do it. It's like doing Strawberry Fields Forever. You know?
Yeah.
The record was the record. That was it. It was a perfect thing. You know, I couldn't imagine doing it any better. You know,
no.
But then again,
well, you love another reason to cover versions is to do an interpretation, do a different version. But no, I don't think anybody wants a different version, because that is so ingrained, isn't it?
No, but what they didn't like was the idea of Noel Gallagher doing it. That's what they didn't like. It's like, he's too successful to do that. You know what I mean? You're allowed to do that if you're poor. You can't do that if you're established. But again, you thought that the debate about him is neither here nor there. It's just an excuse every week
to have a go.
Two or three things to.
This is the thing I'm going to complain. I'm going to go in and give him a real kicking.
And well, we were discussing one of the many topics we discussed outside the pub last night in a wide-ranging Guinness Fuel conversation was the fact that the internet was created so that middle-aged men could have the illusion of feeling that they were having the last word.
Yeah, exactly.
On every subject, you know.
Yeah.
And so you get something like Noel Gallagher, Lovers and Terrors Apart, or Royal Blood, or whatever. Every man, and I think this is men, every man adding his comment on Twitter or whatever, having done it, sits back, folds his arm, and thinks, well, that's sorted that out.
That's ended that one.
That's everybody else has stopped mid-tweet. That I think Fred Smith over here has spoken for all of us.
Yeah,
of course it doesn't work.
Well, then he goes back and has a look. He's covered that 4,000 other people have done exactly the same thing. And sat back, as you say, kind of with their arms folded, immense satisfaction.
Yes,
I'm in charge here.
Absolutely,
and it's so absurd, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And,
you know, I mean, Royal Blood must have been absolutely throwing their hats in the air.
Oh, well, I don't know. Their manager may have thought, no, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. But, you know, if you get that level of criticism, it doesn't matter who you are, it's hurtful. It is hurtful.
The thing that might have hurt them was the fact that it was all about them being so posh, you know.
Well,
it does sound posh.
Well, which people reach for that so readily nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, they never used to. I don't remember this. I don't remember people abusing Genesis because of that back in, you know, 1973, 74 or whatever. Now that the entire nation has been to university, people are allowed to be really class conscious. Now that they're all middle class, you know what I mean? They're allowed to look down on the supposed upper class. That's the way.
It's also about the shift in the entertainment business, isn't it? There's a really good bit in that John Higgs book, the book we talked about earlier, actually, about Bond and his Love and Let Die book, where he talks about how, you know, it's the house prices in central London. You know, there was a time when you could squat or you could live on very cheap rent in central London, and anybody working, any class of musician could live in London and start developing a band. And he said, he pointed out some statistic about, I think 10 years ago, something like 67% of the artists in the UK charts had all been to stage school or whatever, you know.
So that
you couldn't get into the music business, and actually you probably couldn't get into a lot of media businesses or possibly into drama. You know, unless you were kind of middle class and you had parents kind of sponsoring you, you know. So I think it was quite interesting, actually.
Well, yeah, but you find the same thing. It's like I always think, you know, you don't see it anymore, but up until a few years ago, you used to read obituaries of distinguished editors of national newspapers, whether they're editors of the Daily Mirror or the Times or the FT or the Scotsman or whatever. And what they all had in common, all of them, is they'd left school at 15 and they'd gone to work as a copy boy.
Yeah, they had. They'd been a runner or something like that.
Then their way up. Nobody does that anymore. You know, they're all Oxbridge, you know.
Oxbridge, and it's work experience for about 2 years and then suddenly start writing articles. You know,
yeah.
Absolutely right.
And, you know, so that the shape of these things has changed all the time. And, you know, the way it was true, you know, that people could live in squats and so forth in the middle of London. And, well, the same thing in New York, certainly.
Completely. You know, that was the whole thing about
like the loft scene and all that.
Yeah, the whole,
you know,
Talking Heads, Ramones, you know, Blondie, all that. That whole late 70s thing was all about them living in kind of, you know, virtually empty apartments, so virtually no rent and having the room to the space to rehearse and develop their act, you know.
But anyway, those days are gone.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
We were talking the other week about how some sort of classic, iconic acts had nonetheless kind of rather faded in public esteem, arguably, over the years. We thought Jimi Hendrix might have been one. It feels like Jimi Hendrix's star was higher 20 years ago than it is now. And there's been some response from the listeners, hasn't
there? Well, there has. There's a really nice email from a guy called Peter Nuttall, who said, if you want an artist whose stock has really plummeted in the last 30 years, look no further than the Doors. I thought that was true, actually, and I couldn't work out why. But I felt it was true. I think one of the reasons might be that the Oliver Stone movie was pretty poor. Do you remember that? Had they had a movie, the equivalent of a kind of Bohemian Rhapsody type thing that kind of shored up your reputation, might have made a difference. I said, I don't think there's any real story with the Doors either, apart from the death of Jim Morrison. I don't think there's any great narrative going on. I don't think there's any great warmth about any of them, actually, any of the individuals. I don't think there's anything propelling their back catalogue at all. Do you? Do you feel there's anything pushing
that? I don't know. I feel that... I don't know. I think they still stand for a certain kind of, forgive me, cool.
Yeah.
And I think there are people who probably still like, you know, Riders on the Storm and, you know.
Yeah.
Texas Radio and the Big Beat and all that kind of thing. And but there, it's interesting, the parallel with, you mentioned Bohemian Rhapsody and, you know, and Elton John. And, you know, the things that tend to endure, the things that are probably slightly less blokey, would you say that? You know, that Queen became, you know, everybody's middle of the road, didn't they?
Really? Yeah.
You know, it's like, I know there are exceptions to this rule, but I always thought that everybody likes at least some Queen records.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with Elton John or whatever. You know, they were quite mainstream. The Doors less so, I suppose. But yeah, there's also something from, who was it, Giles?
Oh, Giles Fraser wrote a really nice thing saying, it's a really good point. It's just straight out of your worlds. So I remember a film PR woman, we've been talking about publicity, in the mid-80s, telling me she spent a week organising for Sting to be mobbed at Cannes. And then the next day, after the mobbing, getting him on daytime television to complain about being mobbed. Really, really good. That's how PR works.
Well, it's also the great truth about, you know, fame in pop music, you know, or public attention in pop music.
Yeah.
There's either none at all, or it's really tiresome.
Or it's too much. Yes.
There's nothing in between. There's not a reasonable.
No one ever says I'm happy with my level of adulation. You know,
it's never quite.
It's absolutely true.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But he said, talking about people with their reputation waning, he said, I think this relates to quite a number of the heavier acts of the 70s, which is that they're less popular because they aren't really conducive to being listened to in a group or social setting. So my turntable's in the kitchen. Relatively few records get the approval of my wife and my 3 20-something daughters. Indeed, my wife categorizes music as either jolly or noisy. So Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin and Bowie and punk are all fall into the latter category. I played Supper's Ready by Genesis the other day. My 26-year-old said, can you turn that off? It's doing my head in. So I reckon these noisy acts just don't have any growth demographics right now, he said. So the records, all pretty MOR that seem to make the cut, are Rumours, Avalon, Making Movies by Dire Straits, Supertramp. That's interesting. And also Nick Drake, John Martin, Jackson Brown. Well, that's quite an interesting point, actually.
I think it's a very interesting
point. If you play loud music, or music that just, you can't really appreciate, Led Zeppelin's a really good example. It doesn't work played soft. So you're playing it loud, it's then an assault, and it's quite aggressive. It's a challenge, actually.
Yeah,
you know, you've got to react to it. Whereas if Nick Drake's playing in the background, or Jackson Brown or something like that, it can just dawn on you that you quite like it.
Yeah, and also, if you're of a mind to ignore it, you can ignore it.
Not
at all. Whereas, you know, the successful playing of Led Zeppelin's Trampled Underfoot, let's say, picking an example, completely random, in a social circle with, you know, five people in the room, depends on there being present in that room at that time five people who want to listen to Trampled Underfoot. I want to listen, and if you want to listen to Trampled Underfoot, you want to listen to nothing else, and you want to have all other sounds banished from the room apart from the sound of Trampled Underfoot. The same thing does not apply to playing, I don't know, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash, it can just go on.
It can
in the
be foreground music, it can be background music.
Absolutely.
It can just be there. You can dip into it, you can dip out of it. It's not completely gripping and compelling, you know.
Yeah, and I think Giles has got a very good point there. And I think it's probably the case that, you know, as music, you know, we go through different stages with the music. You know, it starts off as something you play in your room. You know, and then it becomes something maybe you play in an office or something. And that then has to obey certain regulations, doesn't it? You know, we've worked in offices where people play music all day long, and there were certain things people just couldn't play, even in a room full of five people who'd heard everything there ever was to hear. There were just some things that were going too far in terms of your personal taste and so forth.
Yeah.
Whereas nowadays, where do you listen to music most often? You probably, as Giles says, you know, in the kitchen,
yeah,
or in the social spaces of the house, you know, where the family are gathered, and therefore there's a tolerance, there's less tolerance for certain kinds of things.
I couldn't think of the last time I'd put on a record with my kids now in their late 30s, so it's and they're not here that much. But you know, I can't think of the last time I actually put on a record with all of us in the same room listening to it. Can you? Is that something you still do?
Well, I tell you, you know, at the end of every year, Spotify do a little audit of your most played tunes.
Yeah.
Of the whole
yours
year.
Was Teddy Bear's Picnic, wasn't it?
And it was Teddy Bear's Picnic and The Sound of Music.
That's right.
Because I've got granddaughters who rather like both, you know. So that's very often when you tend to play things, when the children are there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You're trying to distract children at the end of a long day or something.
There's no chance of Trampled Underfoot coming out, really, is there?
No, but oddly enough, do you know what they like? They like the Bee Gees.
They
like Staying Alive. They like disco music.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, these are only small children. But there's just something very engaging about
completely
that.
Completely winning about it. Exactly. There is.
And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that at all. You know, what a fine achievement on the part of the Bee Gees. So, yes, if you've got your own nominations for
acts who are just slipping out of view, I think that's right about the Doors. I really do. And the Doors, they had some kind of, well, there's a whole thing about, you know, the lyrics of L.A. Woman and Thomas Pynchon and all that was very fashionable at one time, that kind of crime novel thing. I think most of their references have slipped away. And there's also something just baroque and indulgent about them. It doesn't really work in the modern world, really. Jim Morrison doesn't. That hasn't survived, I think. The concept that Jim Morrison is somehow wonderful, the bohemian, you know, the Lizard King, the poet, you know what I mean? I can't say that. Are people still flying the flag for him? Not as much.
We shall find out.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So we're joined by a birthday guest. Very nice to see him again. Ray Roscoe. Ray, happy birthday. And you have a proposition or a query or a theory or whatever to put to us. And what is it?
Right. I suppose to quote the heading of an article I read on this man, we need to talk about Kevin.
Yeah. All right. Oh,
that's
yeah.
good. That's good.
Yes. As Guy, I took my cue from you, David. You the other week you went and discovered Caravanserai again, I think.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, well, I'll have a look at my album collection. And I have Millionaires and Teddy Bears, a 1978, 79 album.
This is Kevin Coyne.
Kevin Coyne is the man. Kevin Coyne is the man. I haven't thought about Kevin Coyne or played his music for 40 years, I
there
reckon.
There you go, yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't know he was still, well, he's no longer with us, died in 2004. But he did have a little burst in the 70s. He's on a par with this audience will probably know, but the sort of Roy Harper, Syd Barrett, John Martin, that sort of 70s singer-songwriter. But he was he wasn't folky, he was bluesy. He came from a blues root, sort of acoustic, Elmore James-type blues, very aggressive acoustic guitar. And his lyrics were very angular and challenging, a big Peel favourite, and lots of Peel sessions is probably where I found him. And
yeah,
Peel
played him a lot. Yeah.
And but now completely forgotten. And I went to play that album again. I thought there's some really good stuff on this. And this was the album that he was on Virgin at the time. In fact, he was the second act.
Signed. He was. He probably had an album came out the same week as Tubular Bells, actually, which is probably a mixed blessing.
Richard Branson had this idea he was going to turn him into the next Joe Cocker or something. And that was...
Yes, because he had curly hair, so it was easy to believe
and
that.
Vocal, bluesy vocal sound. And but, it never happened for him. He did... this album, Millionaires and Teddy Bears, that was the big push by Virgin. And I think it was... I saw a quote saying, if this isn't a hit, I'll eat my hat.
Yes. They were always saying stuff like that. I suppose the interesting thing is that you say he's forgotten, but you're talking about him here.
Yeah.
No. And what we've learned about all these people is that in the fullness of time, they all get their moment in the sun. They may be dead before it happens, but they
he died
happen.
A while ago. He died about 20 years ago, I think, didn't he?
Yeah. I think
that's one of the reasons that the flag isn't necessarily still flying. But Dave's right. Everybody they have their moment. They get somebody will cover a Kevin Coyne song.
I hope so.
It'll appear on the soundtrack of a movie or something.
Oh,
or
I wish.
Get another.
I wish that would happen. But I wouldn't have discovered it had I not had the tangible object, though, David. I had not had the album.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You don't get pushed his way. If you on Spotify, if you do. I know John Martin Radio or Roy Harper Radio. He never comes up. He's never listed as another option you'd listen to. Never on anywhere's list. Only when you go in and have a look, got the album. And then I go on this fantastic adventure. The guy's far more than a musician. An artist. He's had a retrospective at the Tate Gallery. He published books. He's written plays. He did an album about a 30s northern comedian called Frank Randall. That became a musical.
Frank Randall. I know Frank Randall.
Do you?
Well, not personally, but I know of Frank Randall. Frank Randall was a very well-known northern comedian of the kind of pre-television age. But let me show you something here, right? Before Kevin Coyne was a solo act, he was the prime mover of a group called Siren.
Indeed.
He made a record on Dandelion. And I got it.
Isn't that amazing? That is good,
I got it. That is Strange Locomotion by Siren. There you go, on the Dandelion label.
Great.
Came out God knows what year. 1971. Ho ho! There you go. I ought to have it on my massive playlist of everything significant that came out in 1971. So there
Dave
you are.
Dave Flagg is in the band, isn't he? Dave Flagg, the bass player?
Yes. Yeah, David. Well, I think they were also, didn't they also appear as Coyne Clagg? I think they did. I seem to remember. So this group, Dave, Kevin Coyne, Nick Cubworth, Dave Clagg, Mick Grattan, and Tat Meager. It was produced by David Clagg. So 1971. So, nothing is forgotten.
Yes.
Nothing escapes.
No.
The all-seeing eye, a word in your ear. So, you know, you may say he's forgotten, but for one brief moment, he's not. Yeah, thanks to you. So there'll no doubt be other people who listen to this thing. Do you know, I have a copy of Marjorie Razorblade or whatever his other records were. Marjorie Razorblade was a double, I think. I think it was a cheap double on the Virgin label. Sorry if I digress. You know, he's not forgotten now. Thanks to your sponsorship. So thanks for doing that. You know, that invaluable public service. Mm-hmm. And thanks for coming along yesterday to Word in Your Ear, Word in the Park. You had a good time.
I enjoyed it thoroughly. It was an excellent day. And slightly worrying, some of those stories about Mick Jagger and the Stones. And
oh, my God, there were some revelations, weren't there? Mick Jagger's affair with Mick Taylor.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I think it was kind of news to me. I still can't get it out of my head. But there we are. That's why Mick Taylor left the band, supposedly.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
And we're joined by another of our birthday Patreon supporters celebrating his birthday, Paul Thompson. Hello, Paul. How are you doing?
Good morning. Yes, very well. Thank you. Yes.
And now, Paul, you've got a log to throw on the fire.
I have, yes. It's just this week, BBC seems to have gone completely over the top with their AI reporting, and they're saying that it's going to be the end of civilization as we know it.
Yes, I saw that.
That's right.
which is slightly worrying. But
yeah, one of the guys who co-invented it is kind of intensely regretful about it, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. And I was also reading something in the Financial Times about the fact that music now is being developed through AI, and people are having their voices kind of turned into famous singers' voices. Apparently, there's been albums by people produced like Oasis with Liam singing, and there's been songs in the charts with songs which have got other singers singing on them. Just wondering what is this going to turn into? Is it going to be something?
I wish I knew. I don't think anybody knows what it's going to turn into. But it strikes me that there's a lot of kind of repetitive labor in the making of any kind of creative product, and I think AI will do a lot of that. Yeah. Certainly, first of all, but I suppose the one thing you can guarantee is that the more sophisticated the kind of fakery, the more demand there will be for a personal encounter with whoever is supposed to have authored the music. Because what works when pop music is not just the music, it's the combination of the pop, of the music and the personality. It's the person you attach it to. Yeah. And therefore, you know, those personalities are presumably going to become more and more valuable as time goes on. You know, that people are going to be more bothered about going to see their favorite or meeting their favorite or whatever, having some kind of personal encounter to make up for it. That's my prediction.
Well, you can't. Yeah, half the attraction is just the author, isn't it? Their lives, what they're saying, your relationship with that person. And if you're not convinced there's a person involved, it'd be very hard. I don't know. I thought it was interesting that, Dave, you did an interview, I think it was for Radio Times, I think, with Neil Tennant, and asked him about it. And Neil Tennant said, I can see why people would use it as a tool. The idea is you get stuck writing a song and you think, well, if you ask AI to see if they can get from point A to point B and see what they come up with, you know, you could reject it and come up with your own idea. But at some point, you might do that and then think, I'll use it. And then if you use that, you might not be tempted to use more if you're convinced by it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's possible that it might. Absolutely nothing I've heard so far has been remotely convincing or moving. But I'm sure it will be. I'm sure it will only increase and get better. Yeah.
Well, nothing I've heard would convince me that it was a useful thing. But it's that sort of artistic process, isn't it, where you can generate new ideas and maybe use them, maybe not use them, which sounds like it might be useful.
So, exactly. And once you started doing that, I think you'd be tempted to carry on doing it.
Yeah.
But then if you could, as Dave says, a lot of this stuff is just drudgery and just hard labor. Yeah. And anything to get around that would help, you know. be attractive.
Yes. It remains the case, as P.G. Woodhouse said, that the secret of creativity is first apply the seat of the trousers to the surface of the chair. everything else follows from that, you know. But we should keep an eye on that, Paul. That's all we can say, really. We don't have answers. There may be people listening who do have answers and are closer to the... Closer to the thinking. Well, look, thanks very much for that. And happy birthday as of last week.
See you next time.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.